Lester Cole, in 1934, you were active in the Screenwriters Guild, and at that time you were visited by two members of the Communist Party. What happened as a result of that visit?
Well, they were eager to have me join in what they felt was a common fight against fascism, which could be most effectively conducted through the Communist Party, and I said I'd try it out, see if it would work. And it seemed to me that it did. That was the best way to fight against fascism, both here in those incipient fascist groups that are growing up, against Nazism, against Hitler, and against Mussolini. It seemed to me to be a good way.
You had previously, however, always leaned toward Marxism and socialism.
Certainly toward socialism. I didn't know too much about Marxism, but some. And I did lean toward it. Yes, I did. So it seemed to me to be a natural step going in a direction in which many people then, younger and older writers and all kinds, Theodore Dreiser and other people were moving in this direction. And I spoke to some, tried to find out what I could, and it seemed to me to be nothing perfect, but one of the better ways to make this fight in which I was terribly interested.
While it would be an obvious reaction to Nazism and fascism, did you ever perceive it as perhaps undermining America?
No, I couldn't see that. I could see it, and from all I read in the literature, it was to enhance and enlarge and to increase democracy and go towards socialism, which was the idea. And being of socialist mind myself, that's the way I wanted to go.
Well, what were some of the activities of the Communist Party during that period in the 30s and 40s as it sought to change the American political system?
I don't think it sought, particularly under its leadership then of Earl Browder, starting with something called the Democratic Front, which was its objective to bring all kinds of democratic and progressive people together in a fight against reaction and against fascism. That seemed to be its objective. And I couldn't see it as any other thing but that. And it seemed to me to be terribly important. For example, I think that the Communist Party and many other organizations which supported Roosevelt had this in common. What they didn't have in common, and where there were objections, were in some of his foreign policy. When Roosevelt failed by his neutrality to help the legally elected government of Spain, I was opposed to him. So I helped them in whatever way I could, financially. Others with myself helped the Abraham Lincoln Brigade, the volunteers who went over and fought against Franco, Hitler, and Mussolini in Spain, to buy ambulances, to send over doctors, and to do what we could.
You kept your membership secret.
At that time, yes. It seemed that one's job was in jeopardy. To be called a communist was always, there were people ready to, and particularly, let's not forget, I was in a position there as one of the organizers of the Screenwriters Guild early in 1933, where already just by organizing that, before I was a member of the Communist Party, I was known as a Red, who was trying to take over Hollywood through trade unions. And, of course, this was absolute nonsense, because the screenwriters desperately needed a guild to protect both their economic and their writing interests. All of them were, it was absolutely necessary. It was only proven later on when a newspaper guild came into being and when the Actors Guild came in. These were the things which happened because it was necessary. Men and women needed them.
Nevertheless, you felt, however, that your career would be compromised should people find out that you were a member of the Communist
Party. I think so. Yes, I think so. We did, because people were saying that I was not replying to that. They were saying this was the purpose in organizing the unions. This was a communist idea to organize unions. Well, you can't, how could you fight that except to say that it isn't so and to prove it by your actions, which we did in the Screenwriters Guild.
Of course, it had long been alleged that the Communist Party sought to overthrow the United States government by force and violence. Is this true, and were you ever a party to anything like that?
Neither is it true, nor was anybody I ever knew a party to it. But this was finally proved after the heads of the Communist Party under the Smith Act went to prison for 5, 8, and 10 years, and all communists went underground. Long after they were released, one attorney who never stopped fighting, named John Apt, fought through, and I think it was 1970-71, when the Supreme Court of the United States agreed that the Communist Party was a legal party, that its purpose was not to overthrow the government by force and violence, and so at that point it became a legal action.
When did you make known your membership in the Communist Party?
Shortly thereafter. I returned. I had gone to Europe. I had a play produced over there in Czechoslovakia. Then I went over. I was invited to go over by the People's World, which was the left-wing paper on the West Coast, a weekly. I went over to attend and report on a documentary festival in Leipzig, an international festival of documentary films in Leipzig, 1972. And I signed my name to that article in the People's World. Shortly thereafter, I became a correspondent for them, or rather a film critic for them, a drama critic. Shortly thereafter, I also became a teacher of film writing at the University of California in Berkeley, and then I moved over to San Francisco to the extension over there, and I'm still there.
So it wasn't until the early 1970s that you confirmed your membership in the
That's party. Right, yes.
Are you still a member of the Congress?
Yes, I am. Yeah.
Lester Cole, who were the Hollywood Ten?
They were seven writers, one a writer-producer, Adrian Scott, Edward a director, Dimitrik, and Edward Biberman, a director. Then there were seven writers, John Howard Lawson, Albert Maltz, Ring Lardner Jr., Alva Bessie, God, I hope my memory will hold. Myself, that's seven or eight. Let me see, who else I can think. I mentioned Bessie, Maltz. I think that was about it, yeah. Pretty close.
In 1947, you and the others were subpoenaed to appear before the House Un-American Activities Committee, which was then chaired by Congressman Parnell Roberts.
Thomas.
What happened at that hearing?
Well, it was carefully prepared. We had in Hollywood an opposition group which had set up a company union against ours. They were immediately recognized, 40 or 50 men, women. No, maybe there was a woman among them. I don't know. But at any rate, just a handful of writers, mainly from MGM and Paramount, right-wing, high-salaried men. They said instantly recognized by Thalberg, Irving R. Thalberg, who was one of the top guys at MGM. And that was 36, we lost a lot of ground with them. But we said we ordered no writers who were members of our guild to join or to sign any contract until 1938 when we were promised an NLRB election. We had that election in 1938. NLRB is National Labor Relations Board. We overwhelmingly won. We were recognized as the legitimate bargaining agent for writers in 1938. It took us 3 years until we finally said we'll strike within 2 weeks. And the day before the strike, they sat down to bargain with us. And we became recognized. At that point, this disappointed group, determined to fight us through, as the Reds trying to take over Hollywood, there were only 800 and some odd members of the Guild who voted in our favor. And I would say if there were 25 or 30 members of the Communist Party, that was a lot. They controlled nothing. Although they reasoned, they argued, they won confidence from people, not as a party, but as loyal Guild members, as people who were trying to get the best interest for the Guild. And so we became recognized as the Guild. They then became something called the Hollywood Alliance for the Preservation of American Ideals. They got in to support them. Father Coughlin, who was a radio priest in Detroit, right-wing man, Senator Reynolds of North Carolina, who was the head of a paramilitary fascist group called the Order of the White Camellias, and one other famous man whose name, somewhere in the book, his name slips me, who was an anti-Semite, who was opposed to the studios and to what he called all the Jew ownership of this whole industry. And that they were the Jewish international bankers, the same as Hitler called them Jewish international bankers, and of course communists at the same time. So they were the people that these people were opposing. And it took them, the war of course set them back, because the Soviet Union became the ally of the United States. They lost 22 million men in defending, and they were looked upon. A couple of our generals said that they were materially responsible for the winning of the war. So it wasn't until the war was over, after the Yalta Agreement, that Churchill, disappointed with the results of that, said an iron curtain has fallen upon Europe, although he agreed with Roosevelt and with Stalin in the separation that was made of the countries which would surround them, over which the Soviet Union would have protective rights to defend their borders with these countries there. He said an iron curtain has fallen upon Europe, and that was a signal here for the right wing to start the Cold War.
Mr. Cole, in the interest of time,
yeah.
Apparently you were identified as a member of the Communist Party before the House Committee at one point, which led them to subpoena you and the nine others.
I was identified by some stool pigeon, somebody, an informer who was in there. But they had some sort of a number of a card that I had, which was nonsense. I didn't even have a card. If I did, I didn't know it.
All right, you were called before the committee, and the ten of you had a unified form of action. What was that?
That was based upon a rule which would have tricked us, installed by the committee. It was this, by the Un-American Activities Committee. If you answered one question in the affirmative, you must, under penalty of contempt, answer every question that's asked you. So they would start, aside from identifying yourself, so they would start with people like myself. Are you a member of the Screenwriters Guild? Well, of course, this was not only common knowledge. I'd been the president, vice president, treasurer, on the board a half a dozen times. But if I'd said yes to the obvious, I must answer all questions. So I said, I refuse to answer on the grounds of the First Amendment, my right to speak or to refrain from speaking on any subject. Then they asked, are you now or have you ever been a member of the Communist Party? I said the same thing. I said, guilty of contempt of this committee. And that was it. That's all there was to it. I said, can I read a statement? No. Were our attorneys allowed to question some of the so-called friendly witnesses? No, it wasn't. It was an inquisition.
Found guilty of contempt, you were summoned before a judge, and what was the sentence?
The sentence was 1,000 misdemeanor, contempt of Congress, $1,000 fine, and 1 year in prison.
And you went?
To Danbury, Connecticut, after we fought, and it cost us a lot of money to fight through the lower courts to the Supreme Court, where, due to a most unfortunate thing for us, two liberal justices of the Supreme Court, who we knew supported opposition, died 2 months before we came before them. And so it was a 4-4 decision there, which meant they didn't even have to hear our case. So we never got to the Supreme Court, and we simply went to prison in June of 1951.
One of the ironies of life was an episode in prison. When you arrived there, you found a familiar face.
Yes.
Who was
yes.
that?
That was, of all people, the chairman of the Un-American Activities Committee, J. Parnell Thomas. And J. Parnell Thomas was there for that most American of all Americans. He was there for skimming $5 and $10 a week off the top of the wages of the people who worked for him as a reward for having given them jobs. It was Drew Pearson who found that out. He exposed him. The man was thrown out of Congress, and he was tried, and he got 18 months in prison. And he was in there when we got there. Well, that really helped make Ring Lardner and I were the two of the Hollywood Ten who went to Danbury, and that really helped make our stay there much more bearable, because there were ways not physically to torture him, but psychologically. And we found some. And they were successful, and we helped make his last days there miserable.
What did you do?
Well, we got word to him that there was a man in this prison who was not only from the State Department, and as he thought, all important to the State Department. This preceded McCarthy's descent upon the State Department, but that he had great power in the Justice Department. And these were a couple of cons in there who were friendly toward us. So they, when they told him this, and they said, all you've got to do is be nice to this guy, butter him up a little, and he'll help you get parole. Well, at that point, Thomas was in there for four months, and his parole was up in two. So he started a campaign being nice to this prisoner, who played it real tough. He wouldn't get anywhere near him. It frustrated this man, and we had this guy say, be nicer, promise him more, promise him something when he gets out. And he kept making these promises. And finally, when the time for his first parole came at 6 months, and he didn't get it, he was shattered. And this man, really at this point, he said, that's enough, fellas, let's lay off him. So he went to him and he said, look, I don't know whether you think I have any power or not. And whether I do or whether I don't, I'll tell you this, I will not use it in any way for or against you. And he turned and he walked away from him. And 3 months later, Truman pardoned him. What he thought, did this man really have power with Truman as well or not, we don't know. But he lived in dread for those next 3 months to see what would have happened. And when he finally went out, he said on the way out, those goddamn commies, he said, they've got such power, they can keep you in, they can let you out. He said, we'll get rid of them.
Well, prison may or may not have been the worst period of your life, but when you got out and you returned to New York, you found yourself blacklisted, of course. What were those days like just out of prison? I know you had a variety of jobs, and they were not in screenwriting.
No, they were not. I was a waiter, busboy. I was a short order cook. But I found it was a good time. There was an organization called the Arts, Science, and Professions Committee. And we set up, ASP it was called, and we set up and I directed a once-a-week performance of a review, mainly of blacklisted writers and directors. We put on some very interesting shows, music, dance, and it was great. We had some wonderful people in it, and this was creative work. It was communicating with people along real lines. It was for peace and for peaceful coexistence in a decent war, but it was entertainment, very good stuff, and so that kept me. Then I started writing a play, which was eventually produced in Europe, and from there, I finally went after a couple of years. Oh, then I went and got a very good job in a warehouse in Brooklyn. And then my salary went up to $85 a week, and I could live on that. That was all right. I was writing. I wrote a couple of blacklisted things for Time Life, had a weekly thing, and a friend of mine was producing for them. I did a few shows for that. And I managed to get by until I wrote another play. And with that play, which was first produced in Los Angeles in 1956, I went back out there, and it was very well received, and I got two or three offers to work on the black market. So I began to do black market shows, and that was enough. I could make $8,000, $10,000, $12,000 a year.
So you were still blacklisted at this
Still period. Blacklisted. Still blacklblacklisted. Yeah.
Are you still blacklisted?
Well, I have reason to believe so. I have reason to believe so. And the others among the 10 who are not have made their peace with the industry in one way or another. And I just haven't. Because one of the requirements is that you relinquish your principles and your ideas. And apparently, you don't have to do it in public. You just do it quietly in some way, and you can get by. And some did it publicly. Others did it privately. But most of them, those alive, still are open for jobs, although really when you get to be our ages, there are young people coming along that are pushing up, and they're more energetic perhaps, and they've got a better view of what is wanted at the present time, although I'm not so sure of that, because some of the pictures that have come along recently could have come out of our era. And in fact, if they did, we'd have been accused of absolute subversion. Can you imagine if a picture like Red's was made in our time and we had something to do with it? My God, they would have said, they're subverting the American people. Playing the Third International on the screen, showing our hero and heroine as communist revolutionaries. It would have been remarkable.
Are you still angry with history for what happened to you?
No. You can't be angry with history. You have to try somehow or other. I do. I can't speak for anybody else. I have to try in every way I can to make a contribution which will change history however little. And I may succeed, and at times I have, other times I failed. And that's part of life for people who are socially conscious.
How do you compare the political and social atmosphere of today with that of the 40s and the 50s?
Well, the early 40s, or the late 40s, and the 50s were really hysterical in their Cold War atmosphere. Today, equal attempts are being made to create that atmosphere, but they're not succeeding. So far, they're not succeeding. The current administration is doing everything they can, but I think the contradictions in it are so clear. You can't condemn with moral outrage Poland for having martial law and killing seven people in the conflict, and at the same time say nothing about Pakistan, where martial law occurred and 3,000 people were killed, and just slip it right under your arm somewhere and put it away in an envelope. And what happened in Chile? You see, it's just in the paper again today. I think the New York Times is somewhere, this whole story on the Chilean situation. Oh, it's the picture that's coming out called Missing that Costa Gavras is doing. And yesterday's Times had a huge story on it. Admittedly, the U.S. was involved in the overthrow of a legally set up company, putting these fascist military dictators. That's fine. We can do that. But if the people over there seek in their way, I don't like martial law. I wish it never had to occur.
Would you, although you are a member of the Communist Party, would you really feel comfortable under a socialist government of the type that is now in Soviet Union or Poland or Yugoslavia? Would you really feel happy having that kind of system in this country?
I can't even try to imagine. I only know this. I've been there 5 times. I've met some very fine people. Their culture and their ways are so different from mine. I feel I've got a job to do here. Mine is not to live there. I'm not looking for the peaceful place to live. I'm looking for the place where I'm at home, where I belong, where I can operate, whether it's through my books, through my plays, however, to make things a little better than they are.
I wonder if the communist governments would give you a forum of the type you have here.
I don't know. I've not tried. Maybe I will, and make a report and come back and tell you sometime.
One last question. Looking back over your long career and the good things and the bad things, the blacklisting, the prison, would you have done anything differently?
No. Nothing. I can't see how. I can't see what I could have done. Certainly, I could never have been a stool pigeon. I couldn't. I think I would have slit my throat first. I couldn't have done it. And there was no way that I felt that I wanted to get out of it. I didn't feel I was doing anything wrong. I felt I was trying to uphold a legal right for all American people in their own way. There are other left-wing groups that I don't disagree with. But I speak for them, for their rights. There's a group called the Socialist Workers' Party, with which ideologically I disagree entirely. But they have a suit against the FBI at the moment. It's been going on for some time. I spoke in support of them in that suit because I think they're justified that they have been mistreated. So it isn't a question of just one sectarian view. I don't hold any such thing. But I do like to see people get a fair shake. I like to see all people. That goes for the black people in this country, too. They're miserably treated. Miserably. There was something on PBS last night which showed Harlem back in the old days coming up through today. My God, I know some of these black people. It's just, They're second-class citizens. They've gone from one kind of slavery to another kind of inferiority. And a lot is happening. They're making tremendous advances. But it's only because a hell of a lot of people are fighting for it. You see, it isn't because it's being given to them out of the nature, good nature of anybody's heart. Not at all.
Lester Cole, thank you very much.
Okay. Thank you.